You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Monday, April 11th, 2016. I am Michael Brooks, pinch hitting for Sam Steeder, as I do on Mondays, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Ronnie Kalik on the left, identity politics, a great scam at AIPAC, and a progressive critique of PC politics in the Democratic primary. Sure to generate some IMs. Also, in South Africa, President Jacob Zuma is taking a battering, and is the ANC, the Party of Liberation, losing the trust of the South African people. Al-Nusra is making advances in Syria. And are they benefiting directly from our attacks on ISIS? Are we informal partners of Al-Qaeda in Syria? Also, young people are more and more left-wing and progressive, and this outbreak of sanity may even be applying to Republican young people. More on that. John Kerry is in Japan. He brought flowers, but not an apology for nuking Hiroshima. Not even in our bed, just flowers. Flowers are a real double-edged sword in the apology and makeup game on all levels, from the personal to the international. Alex Jones has thoughts about redheads vis-a-vis Africans. Our partner and friend, Cenk Uygur, kicked off of an American Airlines flight. Why? Well, it involves American Airlines being the worst airline ever. Glenn Beck doing an ancient callback to some of his premium insanity put out several years ago. Ted Cruz is chased out of the Bronx. And President Obama, while calling out Fox News, still has to do false equivalency. False equivalency after all these years. It's a little disappointing, but unfortunately expected. All that and much more, including, of course, your calls and your IMs, and we move to the fun half. Ladies and gentlemen, we are at 93 reviews for Two Dope Boys in a Podcast, and it's going really, really strongly, getting into really good conversations on race and gender through the lens of culture and brands. And really quick, Matt, what do we have this week on Two Dope Boys?
Well, to start off, we've got a bit of a discussion into the De Niro Tribeca autism documentary link, which I think we handled pretty well. And then we also have some workplace culture topics, one on, sort of minorities being penalized for wanting to bring diversity into the workplace, and more generally on how workplace culture sort of defined and how that's useful and not. And Phil, for instance, who one of the Two Dope Boys, mentions, gives a little insight into the culture at Goldman Sachs,
which is where he used to work. And then, of course, we have Biz Gormley, who is one of our crew members, and she is an amazing activist, social strategist, and a startup developer. So that's all on Two Dope Boys this week. Subscribe to us at subscribe2db.com. If you're already listening and liking it, write us a review on iTunes. Thank you so much. We will be right back with Rania Kolick.
Oh, let's give thanks and praise unto the Most High. Rastafari, King of all kings, ruler of all kings. I lift up my hands unto the hills. From whence cometh my help? My help cometh from Jah, who has made Zion and the earth. Oh gosh, keep thy strength, mighty God Jah.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I am Michael Brooks, and joining us now is Rania Kolick. She is a journalist for the Electronic Intifada. Rania, how you doing?
I'm good. How you doing?
I'm doing really well. It's great to be talking with you. I've noticed and I've followed your work for a while, and one of the things that I think is really interesting that you have sort of zeroed in on in a number of ways, including ways at times I've agreed with, times I've disagreed with, is this tension right now that we're seeing in like the broad left between, I would say in some respects, core issues of social justice and issues of identity. And obviously they're merged, but there is this way in which, particularly in the Democratic primary, some aspects of identity are being used to evade structural justice issues. And I want to just set you up by noting that several years ago, Tony Judt wrote a piece called Edge People in the New York Review of Books, where he talks specifically about his Jewish identity, and he warned against a certain type of identity politics that could be co-opted by the kind of neoliberal right, which is really interesting because this is a Jewish post-war intellectual who actually critiques Zionism. And, you know, this is like the kind of line of his thinking. So I just wanted to set you up on that and give us your impression of how this is playing out between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders.
Well, I mean, you said it really well, and that's exactly what's happening is, you know, identity politics, you know, we can agree and disagree on the ways it has been used on the left, and it has had its usefulness on the left, for sure. But the problem with identity politics that we're seeing now is that it's able to be co-opted very easily by neoliberals. And I wouldn't even just say right-wing neoliberals. I would say neoliberals across the board. Identity politics is very conducive to neoliberalism because what you can do is you can just, instead of dealing with the structural issues of economic inequality, you can just say, okay, like, I'm just going to appoint a bunch of black and brown people to be in my cabinet, or I'm just going to, you know, I'm just going to have a CEO who's black or brown, or a woman CEO, and then suddenly, like, diversity becomes the way to just say we're making justice, you know, where we're making social justice and progress. And so that's something that has been utilized very, very well by the Democratic Party, which has, for the most part, you know, since Bill Clinton has completely abandoned the working class in many respects and has become a corporate party. But it's a corporate party that is aligned with basically a corporate party that has minority support because it's the lesser of two evils. So it basically, the Democratic Party for the last several decades has basically been functioning on the idea that the right wing is so crazy in this country that you have to elect us. We're the only like opportunity to not have crazy white supremacists in power, right?
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time,
that's a good slogan.
Yeah, that's
an inspiring slogan that should be printed out for the DNC. Yeah,
totally. I'm down with that. But yeah, I mean, that's exactly what's been going on. And then with the like with the election of Obama, I mean, that you know, that really, I think, epitomized a more open and explicit use of identity politics on from the Democratic Party. Because, you know, Obama is like suddenly you have a minority in office. That's a huge deal. It's like important. You have like a black president. But at the same time, we're still having the same issues. Economic injustice has not been addressed at all. You know, the condition of black people, brown people in this country still, you know, persists. Right.
Right.
And so I think that this election, what this election brings with it is now instead of having a black candidate running for office, you have a woman candidate running for office, which is also like another big, you know, it's big deal, right? Because we could have our first woman president. And so you see the Democratic Party, the Democratic establishment, which is entirely behind Hillary Clinton, using using like identity politics and using the rhetoric, in many ways, the rhetoric, which is, this has utterly shocked me this election cycle, is to see Hillary Clinton and establishment Democrats using the rhetoric of privilege and intersectionality discourse to campaign on. I mean, that's very new.
Yeah, like, I mean, it is a little bit like McDonald's coming out with like an organic health food like regimen for people. I think, yeah, it's a little crazy, but I think, you know, to like pick apart what you said, because there's a couple of different components of it. I think that there's, I don't think anybody would disagree with the fact that on some basic level, even if we took just corporate America, of course there is a certain shift that happens when you bring diversity, when you put women in leadership. There is an innate value to that. So even like as a cultural matter and as a sort of like becoming better in some respects, the fact that President Obama can talk about, when he chooses to, policing issues from a certain perspective definitely has a positive impact on culture. I think Hillary Clinton has a positive impact on culture when she talks about certain work-life issues. And that's one track, and I don't want to delegitimize that. But at the flip side,
and then
at the flip side, there's this other track in which we are sort of seeing, and I think, you know, to some, in some respects, this has been exaggerated, like, you know, because the right always freaks out, like, you know, college kids are always like, oh my God, they're so PC, blah, blah, blah. And like in a world where, you know, even if they are, it's like really like in the grand scheme of things, like, come on, like this is a, like our planet is blowing up. Like we really don't have time to worry about college kids being ridiculous. But what is interesting is that you do look at a track that manifests on social media, that manifests on college campuses of a kind of obsessive attention to language and obsessive attention to like call out culture and to identity. And then it starts to get fused in the Clinton campaign's case with sort of like corporate Democrat neoliberal politics. And then you start to create a political fusion that is almost like raw kale that's bad for you. It's like the worst of both worlds.
No, it is, and that was a really great way to put it, too, because that's exactly what's happening. I mean, obviously, we've got, you know, some issues around the language policing on the campus left, but I would also mention that, you know, one thing I've been really impressed by is that even though Hillary Clinton and her campaign are using this kind of discourse that we usually see, like, in academia and on college campuses and stuff like that, college campuses are going way hard for, like, Bernie Sanders.
Right.
Like, that's who they support.
Definitely.
So it's really good to see that sort of rejection of this use of this language from, you know, the neoliberal establishment. But at the same time, you know, one thing that is really concerning is the way that it's this stuff has become very popular, like it's in the media.
Mm-hmm.
Like now you see, and it's really bizarre because a few years ago, this wasn't the case. Like people
Not
weren't talking
all.
About privilege at the New York Times, you know, 4 years ago.
No.
That's a relatively new thing that's so right. popular right now. And it's not necessarily bad, but then you see the way it's being used during this election, and it's suddenly like the mere idea of criticizing Hillary Clinton, the substance of Hillary Clinton's argument as making her unqualified for president, suddenly becomes a sexist attack, right? So right. suddenly any sort of attack on Hillary Clinton's politics becomes sexist. Right. Suddenly you've got Bernie bros. Like, apparently I'm a Bernie bro, right? Like, apparently
Welcome.
I'm a dude now. Welcome. Thank you, yeah.
Well, we do some keg stands later and make sure we have universal health care and ladies never lead us.
Right, exactly. I hope to be a leader in the bro movement myself now that I'm one of them.
Totally.
But yeah, I mean, it's crazy. It's like now Hawaii is not a diverse state anymore, right? Because now the idea is that all these white people are voting for Bernie Sanders. So the way it's been used by the media is really concerning. And I think is like something we should be we'll probably be analyzing it for a while. And I'm not necessarily sure how much it's impacted the overall election. Like, I don't know if people are deciding not to vote for somebody because because Hillary called them sexist or because, you know, Hillary's using privileged discourse, they suddenly want to vote for her. I don't know that that's necessarily happening,
right.
But it's still really interesting to see all this at play. And I would also argue that, you know, while the Democratic establishment is really it's using identity politics right now to distract from the economic inequality that Bernie Sanders is talking about, but they're using it in a way where they're friendly towards, you know, minorities. On the other end of things, you see someone like Donald Trump rising.
Right.
What he's doing is he's employing a different kind of identity politics,
Absolutely.
Which is more common, right, on the Republican yep. side, which is yep. this white resentment kind of politics.
Right.
And I'm not saying that the Democrats are necessarily completely to blame for this, but the fact that the Democratic Party has abandoned working class issues and completely abandoned the white working class completely, it makes it much, much easier for somebody like Donald Trump to campaign on issues of hate and xenophobia and anti-Muslim sentiment and racism. And because he's appealing to people's worst sentiments, and these people, you know, we have to remember they're hurting right now economically. I mean, there is a reason to be resentful. It's just being, I guess, fostered in a very bad way. Being,
absolutely. I think that that's a really important point. And it's, I mean, there's two really like on point things you said. First is that, you know, social media drama is actually a very little part of real people's lives. So we don't know how this is playing out. Absolutely. And then number two, look, if you create a situation where the quote unquote progressive party is basically saying to certain swaths of the country, like, look, socially, you're backwards. You have guns. You don't get gender politics and you're just like fat idiots. And then on the other hand, like, we're totally going to F you when it comes to trade policy. That is an incredible, that opens the door for xenophobes, for bigots, and for people who, frankly, again, even as stupid as it is, will, you know, if you watch a full Trump rally, and this is what people need to do, he says terrible, disgusting things. He says some funny and gross things. He says some genuinely funny things. And then he says, like, yo, I'm going to protect you on trade deals. And that is not an irrational thing in any way to respond to. So that's a really important point. I think what I want to get into with you as well is, like, how do we discover, like, the formula for starting to balance these things? This is a kind of out there example, but I was rereading recently about the African National Congress and the struggle during, like, you know, during the heart of apartheid when many leaders were in exile. And one of the main rivals of the ANC was actually like the Black Pan-African Congress, right? And their politics were rooted in, incredibly understandably, obviously, just like Black identity and the wanting to liberate Africa from white control. That makes total sense. But the economics of it were such that these were actually groups that were more likely to be aligned with like a military junta in Nigeria, more likely to get funding from the CIA. Whereas the ANC was both a Black nationalist and quite culturally identified movement, but they also had connections deeply with the South African Communist Party. They were also committed to non-racialism and this broader struggle of liberation. They were able to find that balance. That's one of the reasons it's such an iconic movement. And I know, like, obviously the liberation struggle in South Africa is far afield from stupid disputes on Twitter, but we need to start finding these examples of balancing these things out.
You know, there was similar stuff that took place around the Black Panthers in the U.S. There were different wings, right? There was like the more black national. Well, you know, there's more like the black nationalist element, almost like a separatist element. And then there was like the communist, the socialist element to it, right? And there's always been, I think, like especially when it comes to various liberation struggles, there does seem to all like constantly be this push and pull between what to focus on and whether economics should be a big part of it. And I think that's what it comes down to. Like what we're seeing right now is we have a younger generation of people like millennials, like myself, who are not doing great economically, right?
And
we identified it, you know, we're a group of people that identify more as working class than ever before. And there's a hunger and an appetite to understand why the economic situation is the way it is when you're doing bad. And so there's a hunger to understand socialism. You have someone like Bernie Sanders who is putting out these ideas about risk redistribution that we never, ever hear on this big of a platform.
Right, absolutely.
To people, and so people are getting interested to understand. And I think that, you know, that socialism is like a really important aspect in educating people about socialism and about like different ways that the economy can work is a really important aspect to like organizing for a better future. Because I mean, economic inequality is not like it's not the only oppression, obviously. Like there are other issues, but you know, it's the one thing that we can all organize around, regardless of what other crap we're dealing with.
And the other thing that's important about that is that no matter how, like, I think you could take I've had people on that have, you know, talked about Bernie. As an example, I talked with Bill Fletcher, who's a brilliant dude, about Bernie Sanders and the African-American community. I think at times, like, you can critique the way he's talked about gender or racial issues at times. But the thing that's striking to me, and this is where my biography comes into it, because, I mean, obviously, from a gender and race perspective, I hit, like, the privileged jackpot, no doubt. But I come from a background of I've dealt with real poverty and money issues, and not like, oh yeah, we were a little stressed, but like actual money issues, actual struggle in that way. And what is shocking to me is the extent to which people feel comfortable going on tirades about how Bernie doesn't get the subtle nuances of each detail of this and that issue, while no one else in frontline politics in the United States has even the beginning of a conversation on class, which is like the hidden common denominator of all of these issues we talk about, and it's not even on the table. So if you want to say, you know, he was off tone on this or that, then you have to acknowledge that every single other person in modern politics, certainly including Hillary Clinton, has no even beginning of an analysis on class issues. And if I'm supposed to like set aside the fact that these policies have personally impacted my family, then I think, you know, you certainly need, if you're coming from another position, actually to think much more rigorously about these class dimensions. And it's amazing that that's not put in the same way.
Well, no, you're absolutely right. And that's not an accident. I mean, there's a reason that class doesn't get talked about. It's because, I mean, who's doing the talking? I mean, the people who are doing the talking are trying to protect a system that enriches them.
Absolutely.
And so class is, of course, off the table. And yeah, it is. You know, I think it's a really great point you made about your own background, because that's another thing. This is one issue I do have with identity politics and that I won't back down from, is the idea that, you know, yes, of course there is a certain level of like advantages you get if you're white, but what does that mean if you're like living in a trailer park? You know, what does that mean if you're living in deep poverty? Like, I don't think it's right for people to go around, you know, this discourse around white privilege is it completely erases the fact that there's a really big difference between being even a middle-class white person and a white person living in poverty. There's a huge difference. And if anything, you know, there's more solidarity between the upper classes, or like that crosses racial, gender, and increasingly sexual identity lines, than there is, you know, between, say, like me and the elites of Saudi Arabia, or like, you know what I mean, or Arab oil, you know, like Arab billionaires.
They're not tight with you? I thought we were going to go party with them. I thought we were getting on the boat. What happens?
Like Hillary Clinton's better friends, like Hillary Clinton's more in solidarity with those people. Than like they are with me, you know.
Right,
like, I think that's the dynamic that gets left out, is that, and that's where class is such a powerful issue to organize around and to understand, because it does bring people together in a way nothing else can, because there's poor people of all stripes. There's, you know, lower class people, working class people of all stripes, and racism and sexism and homophobia are definitely prevalent among the lower classes and the upper classes, but it's something that the elite, that elites have used for hundreds and hundreds of years now, and, you know, still do, to try and keep people at the bottom divided. And so that's why Bernie Sanders' message, even though it's not pure socialism, you know, it's still really powerful and also very threatening to that order. Right. And that's why you see him doing better in polls among across like a broader range of people than someone like Hillary Clinton. That's why there are certain like poor white Republicans who would be willing to vote for Sanders. Not because he's just like some white guy, but because of his message.
Right. Exactly. I think that that's, and also the other element of this too. And again, I'm not minimizing it. Like, all of it is important and interconnected, but there is a certain way in which, you know, like the market state can accommodate social progress, and that's a good thing. But when you start talking about the class dimension, then the baselines are in play. Then we're actually talking about, well, why do resources look like this? Why do we have such an ossified and oppressive system? So you're exactly right. Before we go, I want to play this. Oh, I guess we have a technical difficulty, so we can't play that. That's a bummer. Is it something that could be fixed, like, in a somewhat timely-ish time frame, or no? Maybe. All right, so we're going to talk for another minute and see if this will work a minute. Yeah, but just go ahead.
Well, given what we're going to play, whether it works or not, since it has something to do with AIPAC, I just wanted to note, while we're on the idea of identity politics, you know, the New York Daily News, our editorial board interview with Bernie Sanders last week made big headlines, and he said stuff about Israel in it that made Israeli lawmakers really mad. One of them accused him of a blood libel, which was insane.
Well, they've really made that mean nothing. I think I've been accused of blood libel at, like, a Passover. I'm just like, all right, I got it, whatever. Pass the brisket, please.
Well, then you have some, like, it's just fascinating. It's like, okay, yeah, Bernie Sanders is just, like, dishing out blood libels, apparently. Yeah. But regardless,
it's like, we need to destroy Israel. It's true. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I could totally, that's pretty much what he means.
Yeah, right? That's what Bernie's saying. Death to Israel.
What's fascinating is, like, yesterday Hillary Clinton joined in on this, and so her people in her campaign have been saying that she was going to use those comments that he made to the Daily News to attack him on Israel, which hasn't really been an issue in the Democratic primary yet. And the reason she's doing it is because she recognizes that Jewish voters make up a pretty significant voting bloc in New York. And so she thinks that the way to appeal to them is by being like, I'm better on Israel than the Jewish guy. So that'll be an interesting, if that comes up in the debate this week, that'll be a really interesting and weird dynamic at play, where, like, Hillary Clinton's using Jewish identity and Israel issues to try and frame her opponent as, like, dangerous for Israel and for Jewish people.
Yeah, and what's funny is that, you know, and I think we might have the sound ready to play in a second, but what's so interesting to me, and I think, you know, we'll have more discussions about this at other times, you and I are probably not 100% eye-to-eye on Israel, but what is fascinating to me, as someone who is a long-term critic of everything from the blockade and the, you know, siege and endless bombing and abuse of Gaza to the occupation to racism inside Israel, if you have experience on that issue, including, frankly, just doing what Bernie Sanders did, which all Bernie Sanders has done is actually say he would take steps to enforce what actual U.S. foreign policy is, which is fucking amazing that that's considered controversial. But if you are engaged in that issue at all, the cheap use of something as powerful historically and as genocidal as anti-Semitism, you have experienced the way in which identity politics in a dumb and reductive way can be used to justify pretty much anything. So with that said, you were at AIPAC and you did a really funny prank. Basically what you did was that, you know, and I remember this is the first thought I had about AIPAC. If Donald Trump is such a big deal at AIPAC, well, why not every single Israeli party to the right of Meretz? You should have a problem with hearing from then if you have a problem with Donald Trump. And you went up with the same instinct to AIPAC. There was something going on outside. Some people protesting AIPAC, some people supporting AIPAC, some people everybody opposing Donald Trump. And you found a couple of AIPAC supporters and you read them quotes from Israeli ministers and you told them that they were Donald Trump quotes. And we're going to just play a little bit of this and see what the response was. And then we'll get your thoughts on it.
Yeah? Why do you oppose Trump?
He's psychotic.
Because of his rhetoric?
No, because honestly, he just appeals to whatever he thinks some bigots think on any given day. One day he's for this, the next day he's talking to another pad of bigots. He's
like when he called migrants cancer?
There you go.
The culture minister of Israel called migrants cancer. Do you think that's dangerous?
Oh, God.
What? Oh, God. Yeah, is that a...
Well, there you go. And there's a lot more like that.
Yeah, that was special. It was really crazy because everybody was lined up to see Donald Trump talk because he was speaking in like a couple hours and they had to move it to a stadium in D.C. because all the GOP presidential contenders were going to be speaking and they just needed more room for people. And so there was just this massive line of AIPAC attendees down the block and around the corner. And then there was also protesters protesting, you know, an assortment of things from Donald Trump to AIPAC. And so it was, this is the time that happened any time during the rest of the week. But this is the first time that AIPAC attendees were sort of forced to be around protesters and face them face to face. So it was also easier to access them because like I was denied press credentials. A lot of people were who just like aren't, you know, in big media outlets. And so I couldn't get into the conference. And so this was my one chance to just like talk to AIPAC people. Without, you know, having to yell at them on their way in. So I mean, it was really fascinating. I mean, I read them quotes from Netanyahu calling Palestinians wild beasts, and it was crazy because they would obviously denounce it because it's horrible, but right. I would say that Donald Trump said it against immigrants here. Right. And then the second I would say Netanyahu said it, it was like, just like something clicked in their brain, and it was like, oh, well, that's fine. It's different. It's totally different.
Totally different.
And just justifying it. And so, yeah, it's like that's what's happened around the issue of Israel is Jewish identity is weaponized in a way where like it's just like used to manipulate people into supporting Israel and supporting really awful things that they would never in a million years support in the U.S. because otherwise it's just like terrible and you know it's wrong. And I think that's actually really dangerous. It shows the dangers of what identity politics when used the right way can do. It can make people support atrocious things that are completely against their own morals and principles.
Right. And I mean, I remember, you know, as a final thought, I've talked with Ronnie Kosrolls a couple of weeks ago, who's a former, again, back to the ANC example, was a, you know, an ANC commander and a Jewish revolutionary, and his sort of solidarity work in the Middle East, he sees as just seamless with his anti-apartheid work because the baseline motivator is this sort of quest for justice, which he sees as reflective of his Jewish values. And, you know, I do as well. But Rania Kalik, I really appreciate your time. We'll have to do this again sometime soon.
Great to be on with you. Thanks for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, everybody. We are going to go to the fun half where you can join us at 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. Subscribe to Two Dope Boys and a Podcast today at 2db.com. Subscribe to the Majority Report on iTunes. Even if you are a member, it still helps us move our way up into the rankings. Write the Majority Report a review. JustCoffee.coop, Fair Trade Coffee, Tea, Chocolate, all of that good stuff. It helps the Majority Report. It helps the workers. It helps the co-op economy. Go to Majority Report Kickback, where you can use our link to Jet.com. That's the socially responsible Amazon or Amazon itself. And give us a little taste. Let us wet our beaks a little bit. IMs are open. Phone is ready. We will see you in the fun half.